Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for a Monday, May 2nd, 2022. Campaign 2022 season in full swing. A dozen states holding midterm election primaries in the month of May, which could put to the test the influence of former President Donald Trump as he endorses his favorites. During today's program, we'll look at races in two states, Georgia and Ohio. In Russia's war with Ukraine, in Mariupol, first civilians evacuated from that massive steel factory that's the last holdout of Ukrainian fighters. As the U.S. State Department issues a warning that Russia could next move to solidify its control over seized eastern Ukrainian territory through sham referenda. The U.S. Senate returning to session and on their plate a $33 billion military and economic aid request from the Biden administration for Ukraine. But the question is, will it be tied to more COVID program funding? C-SPAN 2's Book TV talking with Dr. Deborah Birx, former White House coronavirus response coordinator under former President Trump, on her new book about what it was like working for the former president and how prepared the U.S. is for the pandemics that may be coming ahead. And President Joe Biden remembering his friend and colleague, former Senator and Vice President Walter Mondale, memorial service this weekend. It was delayed a year because of the coronavirus pandemic. We start in Georgia. The Capitol Beat News Service in Atlanta writes that Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, three Republican challengers, accused him Monday of failing to adequately investigate allegations of voter fraud following the 2020 presidential election. Raffensperger shot back during an hour-long debate live-streamed by Georgia Public Broadcasting. His office examined every allegation and found nothing that would have affected the results. Raffensperger's opponents in the May 24th Republican primary include U.S. Congressman Jody Heiss, Republican, former Alpharetta Mayor David Bell Isle, and T.J. Hudson, former probate judge. And the article goes on, Heiss has been endorsed by former President Donald Trump, whom Raffensperger crossed in early January of last year when he refused in a taped phone conversation to try to find the votes necessary for Trump to overcome his loss in Georgia to Democrat Joe Biden. C-SPAN covered the debate today. Here's the question first to one of the challengers, Congressman Jody Heiss.
Congressman Heiss, Donald Trump did not win the 2020 election. This was shown by multiple three vote counts, multiple investigations, court cases, the Department of Justice, the FBI, the GBI, the Secretary of State's office. They have all looked at dozens and dozens of allegations, but it seems like you still believe the myth that the election was stolen. How can voters trust your judgment if you're elected Secretary of State?
Thank you, Mark, for the question, and thanks to the Atlanta Press Club for having us here. Look, the big lie in all of this is that there were no problems in this past election. This election was filled with problems, beginning with Brad Raffensperger unsolicited sending out 6.9 million ballot request form, knowing that our voter registration file is some 10% inaccurate. Then we have drop-off boxes that were added to the Georgia election. We are now watching footage in the tune of thousands of hours of ballot harvesting taking place in this state. Listen, this past election was an absolute disaster under the leadership of Brad Raffensperger, and it's for that reason that I'm leaving a very safe congressional district to take on one that I believe is the worst Secretary of State, perhaps in our nation, but certainly here in our own state. Election security must be protected, and Brad Raffensperger let that ball majorly fall.
We are going to allow rebuttals here for direct mentions and direct attacks. Mr. Raffensperger, you want to take 30 seconds to answer that or wait till later?
Well, Jody Heiss is lying. If you look at the election of 2020, what happened at the end of the day is that 28,000 Georgians skipped the presidential race, and yet they vote down ballot in other races. I'm the first Secretary of State to do over over 400 results of our investigations. We sent those to the local prosecuting attorneys or to the Attorney General's office. More investigations ever. I've made sure that we had safe and secure elections. We stood up in the middle of pandemic, you know, security features like an absentee ballot fraud task force to make sure if there was any fraud that we had people like Bobby Christine, handpicked by President Trump as U.S. Attorney of the Southern District, be on my task force to make sure that But here's the real issue that we're facing right now is non-citizen voting.
We'll have to get to the bottom of it. Thanks very much, Mr. Raffensperger. It's 30 seconds or
so. Scott, he called me a liar. May I respond or no?
Well, the rebuttal comes one time, so we'll get to that a little bit later.
Thank you.
Haley Mason, it is your turn to ask a question to Brad Raffensperger.
Secretary Raffensperger, you have said several times over the last 2 years that there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud in Georgia. And you have also, at this point, launched your campaign to prevent voter fraud with an emphasis on preventing non-citizen voting. Can you explain why this is an important thrust at this point in your campaign, given that data?
Thank you very much. I'm the only one on this stage that is fighting non-citizen voting. On making sure that only American citizens are in our voter rolls and only American citizens are voting in our elections. I'm the only candidate on this stage with real business experience, growing a business from the ground floor up. Well, Jody Heiss has lived off the taxpayers for over 7 years now. I am the only one that has successfully outlawed ballot harvesting, and I'll continue to investigate every charge that we see. But I'm the first Secretary of State to do a 100% citizenship check of our voter rolls to make sure that only Americans are on the voting rolls. Over a week ago, Jody Heiss said, quote, that non-citizen voting was not his highest priority. It's my highest priority. I'm the only candidate to draft and pass real election reform measures. Jody Heiss has been in Congress for 7 years now, has not done a single piece of election reform legislation. I'm going to make sure that we push back against Stacey Abrams' lawsuit by fair fight, and we're going to continue to check verify who you are on the voter rolls. Only American citizens vote in Georgia.
Mr. Heiss, rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. You would think that our Secretary of State would be aware of the fact that it is up to the states to secure elections, not the federal government. While I have been fighting in Washington to prevent a federal takeover of our elections, Brad Raffensperger was making deals with Stacey Abrams and opened wide the door for election fraud in this state in every way. You would think that someone would know that his responsibility is to secure elections in this state, but Brad Raffensperger has miserably failed.
Congressman Jody Heiss, Republican from Georgia, now running for Georgia Secretary of State and debating the incumbent up for re-election, Brad Raffensperger. Two of the candidates in today's Republican primary debate, and those two are leading the race, according to a new poll from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Raffensperger at 28% and Heiss, endorsed by former President Trump, at 26%. 2020 election and allegation of fraud also coming up during Georgia's gubernatorial Republican primary debate on Sunday. It was also on Georgia Public Broadcasting. You're going to hear first from former Senator David Perdue and the incumbent Brian Kemp asking the questions. Another candidate, Catherine Davis.
We know that this government, this governor, is not enforcing the law, either safety laws or election laws. He allowed the consent decree. He allowed 7.5 million absentee ballots to be mailed out. He allowed for illegal drop boxes. He allowed for the Zuckerberg money. All of that's outside the law. The reason he continues to lie about me and my background is that he was complicit in this fraud. He let it happen. He denied it happened. He's covering it up, and he is now suppressing evidence.
Governor Kemp, a rebuttal.
Well, David, again, that's simply not true, and you know it's not. But I'll tell you what I have done. I was as frustrated as anyone else with the 2020 election results. And I actually did something about it, working with the Georgia General Assembly to address those issues in Senate Bill 202, the Elections Integrity Act. We've outlawed Zuckerberg money. We've tied photo ID to absentee ballots by mail. We've secured drop boxes to make sure that we don't have those problems in the future. And I stood up to Major League Baseball when no one else did.
All right. Thank you very much. Catherine Davis, you get the next question.
Governor, I want to ask you, you've repeatedly stated that you follow the laws of our state and the Constitution. Article 5, Section 2, Paragraph 2 charges you to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. You have repeatedly said that you can't do anything to reassure the voters that the 2020 election was safe and secure, or that this primary election is going to be safe and secure. What is the harm in using paper ballots in the primary to bring a measure of confidence to the people that this election will be secure?
Well, I certainly appreciate that question, Ms. Davis. And to use paper ballots in an election, You'd have to have an act of the General Assembly pass it into law like we did with Senate Bill 202. The laws in the Constitution in this state, which I have been following, they also dictate who administers elections in the state, and it's not the governor. It's your county elections officials, and it's the Secretary of State, and it's the State Election Board. But again, I was as frustrated as anyone else with the results, especially at the federal level. And we did something about it with Senate Bill 202, tying voter ID. I mean, I was the first person that came out and put that idea on the table, and we now have that in the law, securing drop boxes, making sure that we're not going to have long lines, which the Democrats continue to complain about, and it's their counties where this is happening, making sure that we don't have outside money coming into the process. And I will remind everybody at home, we have paper ballots in our elections. The voting system that we currently has a verifiable paper audit trail, which was counted in the 2020 election, and that was passed by the Georgia General Assembly a couple of years ago.
Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, the debate for the Republican nomination for Georgia governor from Sunday. Kemp is the incumbent facing off against former U.S. Senator David Perdue. You also heard from Catherine Davis. There were other candidates there as well. But Washington Post writing that polls show Perdue significantly behind Kemp, raising the chance the incumbent could clear 50% on May 24th and avoid a possible June 21st runoff. Also today in Georgia, grand jurors have been selected and impaneled in Fulton County to decide if former President Donald Trump and others broke the law by pressuring Georgia officials to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Georgia also has a U.S. Senate race this year. Democrat Raphael Warnock, who just got elected in 2020, up for a full term in November. And on the Republican side, the front runner is skipping tonight's debate. We spoke about it with Jacob Rubeshkin with Inside Elections.
So in the Georgia Senate race, we have one prohibitive favorite candidate. That's Herschel Walker, the former University of Georgia football star, Heisman Trophy winner, endorsed by former President Donald Trump. He is actually not going to be there. He has adopted a strategy of avoiding debates, doing very few public appearances, certainly very few news interviews, and really none outside of friendly media outlets. And that is a strategy designed to preserve his lead in that race, where he currently looks poised to win the primary without a runoff exceeding that 50% threshold. And that's because he's not the most experienced candidate. He's never run for office before, and he does have a habit of putting his foot in his mouth at certain points. And so their campaign is really trying to keep him under wraps as much as they can and in managed environments until they absolutely have to bring him out in the general election.
Jacob Rubeshkin is with Inside Elections, reporter and analyst, joining C-SPAN on the Washington Journal Monday morning. This is Washington Today. Now to Ohio. All eyes on the open U.S. Senate seat, the retirement of Republican Rob Portman creating that. There's a crowded field on the Republican side. Here are some of the TV ads from J.D. Vance, endorsed by former President Trump, and another top contender, Josh Mandel.
Donald Trump has officially endorsed U.S. Senate candidate J.D. Vance.
J.D. is the conservative outsider who will continue Trump's fight to secure our borders, protect the unborn, get rid of the corrupt politicians, and stop Joe Biden. J.D. Vance, Marine, author of Hillbilly Elegy. President Trump's endorsed America First conservative.
Trump fought back, and so have I. Now I'll take our fight to the U.S. Senate. I'm J.D. Vance, and I approve this message.
I'm Josh Mandel. I approve this message, and I want to let you know the three reasons I'm running. Gideon, Judah, and Rosie. I'm running to save America for my kids, for your kids, and for your grandkids. It's time we fight. Boys are boys, and girls are girls. Black Lives Matter, they're the racists, not us. The Bible is a book of love, not hate. If you agree with me, please join me in saving America.
More on the U.S. Senate race in Ohio. We're joined by Seth Richardson, chief politics reporter with The Plain Dealer, Cleveland.com. Thanks so much for being here. Want to talk about former President Donald Trump's influence on this race. Yesterday, a rally in Nebraska, he apparently did not remember the name of the Republican that he endorsed, J.D. Vance.
That's what they're waiting for. They're waiting for one race. You know, we've endorsed Dr. Oz. We've endorsed J.P., right? J.D. Mandel, and he's doing great. They're all doing good.
That was former President Trump in Nebraska. Seth Richardson, where does this race stand?
It stands about where the president said it did, right? Where people are mixing up names and whatnot. And, you know, we thought that the president endorsing would bring some clarity to this race, and it seems to have done anything but that, really. You've obviously seen J.D. Vance, who is the person he endorsed, despite him not being able to get the name correctly. You have seen him, of course, gain some support, but you've also seen Josh Mandel, who is long considered the front runner, you know, still maintaining some support and being very competitive. And actually, in the past couple of days, there's been some polling that has shown Matt Dolan, the state senator and the only candidate who is kind of not run in that sort of Trump lane, actively said, hey, I'm not even looking for the president's endorsement or the former president's endorsement, rather. And he's really seemed to have come on and gotten some support. Maybe it's some of the, people who are like Republicans who are less than thrilled finally kind of coalescing around him. But it's really a wide open race. I think anybody you talk to here thinks it's very much up in the air.
And in addition to former President Trump, got other big national Republican names coming in to make endorsements. Senator Ted Cruz, the incumbent who's retiring, Senator Rob Portman. You got the Club for Growth PAC. What kind of influence has that had?
Well, it's been really interesting because you've seen Ohio, you know, as it often is, be a kind of national playground of sorts for some of these, you know, groups and interests. And, it's really caused a division at the national level because, the Trump and Donald Trump Jr. and those sorts of folks who really kind of push for J.D. Vance to get the endorsement are now at odds with the Club for Growth, which, you know, spent heavily on Trump and Trump-backed candidates in the past. And, you know, they've sort of openly gone against one another. In fact, in one ad for Josh Mandel via the Club for Growth was criticizing Trump for the J.D. Vance endorsement and showing past things that Vance has said about Trump, you know, back in the day, saying he was, you know, an idiot and calling his supporters racist and things of that nature. So it really has led to kind of an all-out war, I would call it. I think in the past I've said I would describe it as a bloodbath, but it would be disrespectful to bloodbath because there's just so much spending. We're talking, you know, upwards of $65 million of spending between, you know, a lot of wealthy candidates who have put their own money in, as well as tons of PACs and independent expenditures that have come in and just blanketed the airwaves.
And on the Democratic side in the Senate race, is there a definitive candidate there?
Yeah, and it's looking pretty clear. Like Tim Ryan, the Youngstown area Democrat who's been in Congress for about 20 years now, looks like he's probably heading toward becoming the nominee. He was really the candidate that Democrats kind of coalesced around pretty early. There were some early rumblings about some other people who may get into the race, but he's got a more liberal challenger in Morgan Harper, a former Consumer Financial Protection Bureau attorney who's been an activist around the state, as well as another activist and a tech executive. Her name's Tracy Johnson. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, Ryan has basically the lion's share of the endorsements. He's raised a very healthy amount of money. So it's looking pretty clear like he's kind of heading toward victory there.
Not long ago, Ohio was the ultimate swing state, teetering between Republican and Democratic control. So looking ahead to the general election for this Senate race, who's favored?
I think you would still have to favor whoever comes out of the Republican primary just because of the shift we've seen in the state. We can point to, you know, Trump's two elections. He won by 8 percentage points both times. That's a pretty good showing. But you also have to look at that midterm where you didn't have, you know, what you saw in other states, which was, you know, a Democratic wave coming through. Ohio was pretty much stagnant on that front, right? Republicans basically up and down the board, with the exception of Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown, who won re-election. And when you talk to people around the state, you know, they always talk about Brown as if he's the exception. Even a lot of Republicans talk that way. So I think that you would still have to favor Republicans in this race. Depending on the candidate that comes out, it could be a more favorable matchup to Tim Ryan. But you also have to consider the national environment, just really the lurch rightward of the state in the past really 10 years.
We're talking with Seth Richardson with The Plain Dealer. Also want to talk about the governor's race. It's an interesting situation. Mike DeWine, Republican, running for re-election. Former President Trump has been criticizing him, but has not endorsed any of his Republican primary opponents. Why?
Well, I think if you look at how President Trump makes his, or former President Trump makes his endorsements, a lot of it has to deal with who, you know, can they win, right? There's always that winning factor because he's always touting his record of, oh, I have endorsed this many people and only so and so many have lost, right? And it looks like DeWine is going to be able to hold off those challengers. Had it been like a one-on-one matchup, there may have been enough kind of anti-DeWine sentiment here that he could be in trouble. But there's four people in the race, and that's just really hard against an incumbent governor. It just doesn't seem to, you know, it doesn't seem to be heading that way. He's not really all that unpopular to the general public anyway. So even if he comes away with, you know, say 40% or something like that, that's probably going to be more than enough to hold off, you know, Jim Renacci, a former congressman, and then a couple of other upstarts who, you know, Joe Blystone being kind of the big one who, you know, has gotten some support, but not enough to really topple the governor. So I think that Trump is, you know, it seems like he doesn't want to endorse DeWine because of, you know, DeWine basically said that he lost the election, was one of the first Republicans to say that. And, you know, Trump obviously had an issue with that. He, you know, tweeted about it and whatnot. So, you know, at the same time, I don't think he can bring himself to endorse someone that he thinks can't win.
Seth Richardson is the lead political reporter with The Plain Dealer. Find his work at cleveland.com and on Twitter at Seth A. Richardson. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Ohio's primary election day is Tuesday. Indiana also holding its elections tomorrow. Now to the war in Ukraine. This from Associated Press. The first civilians evacuated from the bombed-out steel plant that has become the last stronghold of Ukrainian fighters in Mariupol slowly made their way towards safety Monday, as others who managed to escape the city described terrifying weeks of bombardment and deprivation. At the Pentagon, the press secretary John Kirby questioned by reporters.
John, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the apparent movement of Russian troops out of Mariupol. Do you assess at this point that there's no Ukrainian forces there left, or there's still a fragment? And does Russia appear to have significant control over the city such that they feel they can remove their troops and still maintain control over it? Or is this an opportunity for Ukraine to try to stage some sort of counterattack?
Well, there's an awful lot there. With the caveat that we don't have perfect visibility on all Russian units and what they're doing and where they're going, I would just make a couple of big points. We do assess that the Russians continue to pound Mariupol from the air. So Mariupol, the fighting in Mariupol is not done, certainly not from what we can see, because they continue to bombard it. We have seen some indications that they are moving some of their ground forces away from Mariupol. The general consensus here is that that's an effort to begin to move north into the Donbas. I can't tell you what that means. What the Russians believe that means for their occupation of Mariupol or where they think they are, but we have seen some movement of Russian forces away from Mariupol and more towards the north. But that we believe is of a piece of their efforts to try to encircle Ukrainian armed forces that are in the Donbas. Did that get at everything?
Yes, it will. Do you have any assessment as to how much of a force Ukraine still has there and any assessment of the ongoing effort to get civilians out?
I don't have a good hard number of how many Ukrainian forces are still in Mariupol. I would certainly refer to the Ukrainian armed forces to speak to that. We know that there has been some evacuations of some civilians. We obviously urge the Russians to continue to work with the Red Cross and the Ukrainian government to allow those who want to leave to leave and to do it safely without harassment. But I couldn't tell you exactly what the scope of the Ukrainian resistance is still in Mariupol. Again, they're still bombing the city. So I think that certainly is at least one indicator that they believe that the battle for Mariupol has not been won and is not over.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby with reporters in the Pentagon briefing room. President Joe Biden plans to tour on Tuesday a Lockheed Martin facility in Alabama, which produces weapons such as the anti-tank javelins that the U.S. has been sending to Ukraine. This visit comes as President Biden asking Congress to approve another $33 billion in military and economic aid for Ukraine. The Senate is back to start the week. The question, though, remains whether the Ukraine aid will be combined with another emergency aid request from the Biden administration, $10 billion for COVID-19 programs, something that the Senate Republicans are resisting without a vote related to immigration along the U.S.-Mexico border to that COVID aid bill. Here's the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, on the Senate floor today.
2 months into the war, it's clear that support from the United States and our allies has been essential in helping Ukraine resist Russia's invasion. But the bloodshed is very likely far from over, and the cost borne by the Ukrainian people has been immense. According to the UN, at least 3,000 civilians have been killed since the start of the war, and the true number is, unfortunately, sadly, far higher than that in all likelihood. The United States thus has a moral obligation to give the Ukrainian people the tools they need for as long as they need them. More money for javelins, stingers, howitzers, switchblade, unmanned aerial munitions, and much more. And make no mistake, the Senate will move swiftly to get an emergency funding package passed and sent to the President's desk. On COVID. Now, in addition to providing emergency funding to Ukraine, the Senate must also keep prioritizing another round of funds to fight COVID and keep our families safe. On Ukraine funding and COVID funding, Republican obstruction will not serve the American people. Instead of threatening political games, I urge Senate Republicans to work with us to get moving on COVID funding ASAP. Over the past few months, the United States has made unmistakable progress in getting life closer to normal than at any other point since the spring of 2020. But as we all know, it takes is another nasty variant to force new closures of our schools, our businesses, our churches, our communities. Meanwhile, every day that we don't act to pass new COVID funding is another day that other nations place orders on the remaining supply of vaccines, of testing, and of therapeutics, in particular therapeutics.
Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader on the Senate floor, he said that it's his hope that a bipartisan agreement on the $33 billion for Ukraine aid can be brought up in the Senate as early as next week. Sahil Kapoor, NBC News reporter, tweeting, in his Senate floor remarks, Schumer didn't say whether Ukraine aid would be linked to COVID funds. He made a case for both. More on the war in Ukraine. United Kingdom Ministry of Defense tweeting, at the start of the conflict, Russia committed over 120 battalion tactical groups, approximately 65% of its entire ground combat strength. And they write, it's likely that more than a quarter of these units have now been rendered combat ineffective. 120 battalion tactical groups, equating to about 150,000 soldiers. At the State Department in Washington, Michael Carpenter, ambassador to OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, describing Russia's plans to politically overcome, conquer Ukraine. He says the initial plan of doing this in the capital, Kyiv, has now been replaced with local efforts in the cities, including kidnapping politicians, replacing local currency with the Russian ruble, and preparing to implement a new school curriculum. And he says, like Russia did with Crimea, annex Ukrainian territory through bogus referenda.
So just as Russia engineered these quasi-statelets, the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic, now we believe that the Kremlin may be trying to organize a Kherson People's Republic in the Kherson Oblast of southern Ukraine. And here's something that I also would like to highlight. According to the most recent reports, we believe that Russia will try to annex the Donetsk People's Republic and Luhansk People's Republic, in quotes, so-called, to Russia. The reports state that Russia has plans to engineer referenda on joining Russia sometime in mid-May. and that Moscow is considering a similar plan for Kherson. Now, the international community, including the OSCE, where I work as ambassador, has been very clear that such referenda, such sham referenda, fabricated votes, will not be considered legitimate, nor will any attempts to annex additional Ukrainian territory. But we have to act. We have to act with a sense of urgency.
Michael Carpenter at the State Department. Joining him at the briefing, the State Department spokesman Ned Price, who was asked about comments from Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov over the weekend on Italian TV. As CNN reports it, when asked how Russia can claim that it is fighting to denazify Ukraine when President Volodymyr Zelensky is himself Jewish, Mr. Lavrov said, "I could be wrong, but Hitler also had Jewish blood. That Zelensky is Jewish means absolutely nothing. Wise Jewish people say that the most ardent anti-Semites are usually Jews." That was from CNN. Here's the question to Ned Price.
I'm wondering if you're not directly involved in this, but I'm sure you have seen the comments that Foreign Minister Lavrov made in an interview with Italian media about anti-Semitism. I'm wondering if you have any comments on that.
We, of course, have seen those despicable comments. We also saw a number of responses from other world leaders. The one that stuck out to many of us here, was the response from Israeli Foreign Minister Lapid. He is, of course, someone who speaks with a great deal of authority on these matters. It would be impossible to improve upon the response that he offered. As he said, the foreign minister's remarks are both an unforgivable and outrageous statement, as well as a terrible historical error. He went on to note that Jews did not murder themselves in the Holocaust. The lowest level of racism against Jews is to accuse Jews themselves of anti-Semitism. This statement from Foreign Minister Lavrov, it was the lowest form of racism. It was the lowest form of propaganda. It was the lowest form of insidious lies. And I think with it and other not only statements, but conduct from the Kremlin, its top officials, its personnel, including its personnel in Ukraine, the Kremlin is consistently proving that there is no floor when it comes to just how low they can stoop. And this, I think, is just the latest example of that.
State Department spokesman Ned Price in the State Department briefing room with reporters. From CBS News, President Biden meeting Monday with the parents of Austin Tice, the freelance journalist and veteran who was abducted in Syria a decade ago, after saying Saturday at the White House Correspondents' Dinner that he'd like to meet them and talk about their son. This came up during the White House briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
And, of course, the president confirmed a little while ago he's meeting with the parents of Austin Tice. He said Saturday night he wanted to meet with them.
Yeah.
Is there anything more about how that came together as quickly as it did? I mean, obviously they were here in town, but anything else we can learn about getting this meeting together so quickly?
Well, I would say after the president made those comments, obviously we went into action to work to set up the meeting on Sunday and see if Deborah and Mark Tice, Austin's parents, would be available. I would note that since the December meeting with our National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, our principal Deputy National Security Advisor, John Finer, and other NSC officials have met with the Tice family in person on three occasions, including a meeting just last week. And so we have been very closely engaged with the family, and obviously meeting with the president is an additional and more significant step in that regard, but we have been in close touch with them as well.
And what is the current U.S. government understanding of Tice's whereabouts and status?
I don't have any updates to provide to you from here, but what the president will certainly convey, and I'm sure we will have a written readout after the meeting, is that we will continue to do everything we can to bring him, and as we do with any American, home. And I would note that, of course, we have a special presidential envoy for hostage affairs, as you know, and you have become familiar with because of our ability to bring Trevor Reed home. Obviously, certainly a different circumstance, but we have an entire apparatus and effort through the interagency to work and doing everything we can to engage with leaders, with countries, even some we certainly do not have diplomatic relations with, to bring Americans home.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki taking reporters' questions, referring to Trevor Reed, the Marine veteran who was returned to the U.S. from Russia in exchange for a Russian prisoner. More from CBS News. The meeting with Mark and Deborah Tice comes months and months of after months of pleading with the Biden administration for a presidential meeting. It's been more than 9 years since a video emerged showing the freelance journalist bound and blindfolded. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. Supreme Court unanimously ruling that Boston violated the U.S. Constitution by refusing to allow a Christian group to fly its flag outside City Hall while allowing other organizations to fly theirs. The issue was whether Boston, by making a flagpole on City Hall Plaza available for use by certain outside groups, had created a forum for private speech, or whether the flying of third-party flags amounted to a government-backed message. And a federal jury convicting a New York Police Department veteran of assaulting an officer during the U.S. Capitol riot January 6, 2021, rejecting his claim that he was defending himself when he tackled the officer and grabbed his gas mask. Thomas Webster, 20-year police department veteran, was the first Capitol riot defendant to be tried on an assault charge and the first to present to a jury a self-defense argument. President Joe Biden giving today what the White House Office of Personnel Management calls one of the most prestigious awards in the federal career civil service. It's the Presidential Rank Awards for exceptional leadership, accomplishments, and service over an extended period of time. 230 winners from 37 federal agencies. President Biden telling them their work has restored Americans' faith in government, one of his key goals.
It was my honor to reestablish these awards last year after the previous administration made a decision to cancel them. Because these awards are about more than individual recognition. They're a reminder to all of us, to everyone, of the extraordinary capacity, creativity, diversity, and dedication of our federal workforce. And a reminder of why you all the work you do matters so much. You know, a couple weeks before I was sworn in January 2021, I sent a message to all career civil servants, and I meant it at the time, and I still mean it. I told them that we're a team, one America, and I meant it. Over the last 15 months, you've helped us deliver so much to the American people, helping stand up a wartime effort to get the country vaccinated, getting checks in the people's pockets of families who needed help, literally just to keep food on the table, keep a roof over their heads, helping communities rebuild in the wake of storms and wildfires, and caring for our veterans, cleaning up the polluted lands and waters, implementing the bipartisan infrastructure law to deliver good-paying job opportunities and game-changing investments to communities all across America, and so much more. Most of all, you restored the faith of millions of Americans in their government, that their government sees them and hears them, that we listen to them, respect them, and reflect them. You're helping restore their faith that democracy can deliver in America. And by restoring their faith and coming through for them today, you're helping strengthen our country for tomorrow in a literal sense.
President Biden in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, a video wall behind him with the streams of the recipients of the Presidential Rank Awards. The awards created in 1978, same year as the Senior Executive Service was created. Dr. Deborah Birx, former coronavirus response coordinator under former President Trump, publishing a new book titled Silent Invasion, The Untold Story of the Trump Administration, COVID-19, and Preventing the Next Pandemic Before It's Too Late. On Afterwards on C-SPAN 2's Book TV, she describes what it was like to work in the Trump administration and what she sees in pandemic preparedness in the future. She's interviewed by Lawrence Gostin, Georgetown University law professor and director of the Institute for National and Global Health Law.
I've intentionally not brought President Trump into this, but I think our listeners would want to hear just your reflections about that. You've talked a little bit about the Trump administration and comparing it to influenza, to low risk, other things like the virus goes away, sunlight, bleach, hydroxychloroquine. It must have been very frustrating for you as a world-renowned scientist and public health professional to be in the White House at that time. We've only got literally a minute or two. Do you want to just spend, say 30 seconds on that, and then just tell us about your, what you think and hope for the future?
Well, frustrating, but not impossible. And that's the message I want to leave with all of you. You find yourself in situations and people will say things about you and it really doesn't matter because you're there for one reason, to serve the American people. And no matter how frustrating, I've been frustrated my whole life in HIV with many leaders who would tell people if you just took a shower or if you slept with a virgin. I mean, all of these magical thinking this is not unusual. Pandemics are political, and it's our job as public health people to get in there and work every day to do the right thing. Some of it's evident, some of it's inevident. It doesn't matter. This isn't about you. It's about what you know and making that translated into saving lives. The whole last chapter, over 40 pages, is on we continue to make missteps in 2021 and now 2022 because we're doing pandemics by polling, by what we think the American people are willing to do. Give them the data. Show them in real time and they will do the right thing. I just don't understand this unwillingness to put all of the data up county by county, by age band and race and ethnicity. You can blur it enough that there's no violation of HIPAA. We do it every day at PEPFAR.gov. And GPS map every facility where there is a physician and where there is a nurse practitioner. And look at how underserved our red counties are. We have to fix this. We can, but we have to get the right data and utilize it. And magical thinking was prominent in the Trump administration. I fear at times it weaves itself into our current administration, and we just can't let that happen. I know May is coming, and what people will say is, look how low the case counts are. But you know what follows May? A summer surge in July and August across our southern states. So let's get ready now and do the right thing.
Dr. Deborah Birx, Coronavirus Response Coordinator under former President Trump, talking about her new book, Silent Invasion, Untold Story of the Trump Administration, COVID-19, and Preventing the Next Pandemic Before It's Too Late. Interviewed by Lawrence Gostin of Georgetown University Law School, Director of the Institute of National and Global Health Law. Part of Afterwards on Book TV on C-SPAN 2. You can check our listings at cspan.org/booktv. To find out when it's going to air. Afterwards is a weekly interview program with relevant guest hosts interviewing top nonfiction authors about their latest works. On Wall Street today, the Dow up 84, NASDAQ up 201, S&P up 23. University of Minnesota marching band playing Battle Hymn of the Republic on Sunday in Minneapolis, the funeral of former U.S. Senator, Vice President, Democratic presidential nominee in 1984, Walter Fritz Mondale. He was also later ambassador to Japan under President Bill Clinton. Mondale died in April 2021 at age 93, but the funeral was delayed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. One of the speakers on Sunday, current Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat from Minnesota, talking about the time she worked for Mondale.
Walter Mondale told the truth. He obeyed the law. He kept the peace. And despite his seemingly stoic Norwegian cautious manner, okay, correction, Tina, Ted, William, his actual Norwegian stoic manner, he took risks. He led the way, he set a high bar, and time after time, he kept passing it and raising it, passing it and raising it. It was during Mondale's time as vice president that we first met. My first assignment as a college intern was to conduct the furniture inventory. I thought I was gonna write all these policy papers, this was it. My job was to crawl under every staff member's table and chair and lamp and diligently check the serial numbers. As I like to tell students, I learned two things from that summer. The first, the vice president was scrupulously honest. Nothing was missing. And second, take every job seriously, because that was my first job in Washington. And thanks to Walter Mondale, this was my second. I found out way back then that for Vice President Mondale, public service was not about personal glory. It was about the people. It was about democracy. It was about our country.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, at the Walter Mondale funeral in Minneapolis on Sunday. President Biden also giving a eulogy remembering his longtime friend in the U.S. Senate.
You know, every senator wears on his or her sleeve the state they serve. But the love Fritz had for the people of Minnesota ran deeper than that. He loved you all, and you loved him back. It was obvious because Fritz reflected the very best qualities of this state, the warmth and optimism that you reflect. At every turn, Fritz reflected the light of this nation, who we are and what we can be. He called me when I had said in inauguration that we're the most unique nation in all of history. We're the only nation founded on an idea. Every other nation in the world is based on geography, ethnicity, religion, race. We're founded on an idea. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men and women are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, including the right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. And it goes on. Fritz believed that in his gut. I watched him every day for over 35 years in the Senate and when he was vice president. He united people, sharing the same light, the same hopes. Even when we disagree, he thought that was important.
President Biden at the Walter Fritz Mondale funeral in Minnesota on Sunday. You can find the video archived at cspan.org. New York Times adding this. It was Mr. Biden's second memorial service in just 5 days, following one last week for former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright at Washington National Cathedral. But Mr. Mondale had no desire to have his body lie in state or to be remembered in a grand celebration of the nation's capital, preferring a simpler, more characteristically humble memorial in his home state of Minnesota. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more of Washington's top stories sent to you each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.